This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I have an interesting guest tonight. I don't knock everything off my desk. Dr. Vernon Nepi. And Vernon, this is I've not had a neuro man, a neuropsychiatrist perspective on my show yet, so I'm quite excited to have Vernon, and I hope he doesn't mind if I just go all over the board with him with my thousands of questions. How are you, Dr. Nepi?
I am doing splendidly, Eva, and you are welcome to go all over the board.
Thank you.
See whether or not the thousands of questions are answered.
So before we get started, Dr. Nepi's got several books. We probably won't get to all of them. Probably won't get as much as I want into his book because I have a million questions. But tell us what your books are, where we can find them, where we can find you, and a little bit about your background, what you do, and how you can help people.
You're right. I'm author of, depending on how you define books, 7 books, 8 books. And if you want to locate them, the easiest way to locate them is brainvoyage.com. In other words, www.brainvoyage, brain like the cerebrum, voyage, one word, brainvoyage.com. And there are all sorts of links in terms of ordering. And for those of you, incidentally, who have a temptation to order, if you type in the word talk radio under the code, you'll get an extra reduction in that regard. So there are all sorts of books. One of my major ones, the most exciting to me in a way, is the book Cry the Beloved Mind, A Voyage of Hope, a book I spent some 15 years on trying to show for the layperson insights into brain medications and social dilemmas, but more particularly trying to make sure that people understood that there is hope and help out there and that their conditions can be treated very much from a biological point of view, but also approaching them at every other kind of level. And then I've written a whole series of books on déjà vu. The first was in 1983 called The Psychology of Déjà Vu. Have I been here before? And that has become a collector's item. And I realized it needed some updating. And I wrote a whole déjà vu trilogy of electronic books available again on this internet site, brainvoyage.com. There was Déjà Vu, A Second Look, Déjà Vu Revisited, and Déjà Vu Glossary and Library. And I recommend all three of those. And then I've written a book for attorneys on how to make the most of your medical expert witness, because I realize that this is a very specialized area, and one of my specialized areas is the area of forensic psychiatry and forensic neuropsychiatry. I've also written other books, Innovative Psychopharmacotherapy, for example, but that's enough. As for what I do, I deal with the brain. I deal with the brain in terms of higher brain function. So it's a little different from psychiatrists, who in a way are right up there looking at the mind, but really do not focus on that cerebral cortex and limbic system. The other thing that I do is behavioral neurology, which is the other side of this. So behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry together focus on that cerebral cortex and limbic system. Obviously, there are medications involved, and also nutritional supplements for that matter, and that is the area of psychopharmacology. So you've got my professional areas. And then I have some major interests in anomalistic psychology, in how does the brain work? How does it link up with those so-called subjective paranormal experiences? And this has been an area that I've worked in for the last 30-odd years as well. People conventionally call it parapsychology. I call it dimensional biopsychophysics. So this, in a nutshell, is about me. I'm an MD, PhD, with a whole string of other qualifications that you need not know about.
And where can they find you? Somebody wanted to contact you.
Oh, if people want to find me, they could go to my website. My website is pni.org. So that is PeterNormanIvan.org, or better, Pacific Neuropsychiatric Institute. And so they could go to the Pacific Neuropsychiatric Institute, and they will find the largest website in neuropsychiatry, probably in the world, and linking up there all sorts of thoughts about anomalistic experiences. Something very exciting, we've just loaded a whole string of new papers on that website, even this week. So PNI.org, www.pni.org. I'm physically based in Seattle, although I'm also adjunct professor at St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri, but I'm director of the Pacific Neuropsychiatric Institute.
Well, I have to tell you something. This Cry the Beloved Mind book, I thoroughly enjoyed that book. I mean, it wasn't talking so far over my head that I couldn't understand, and you gave stories so that we could relate our lives. And I would read it on the train to work every day and back, and I couldn't put it down for weeks. It was
Eva, thank you so much for that. And I've had that repetitively from readers the whole time. The reason is it's very simple. I wrote this for the ordinary person. I wrote it for the layperson, but I tried to make sure that it was comprehensible. And the way I made it comprehensible was I made it into a kind of fiction. I created composite case histories, but I made sure the education was there. So the scientific facts were there in relation to this. And because of it, I had to form a whole new literary genre called skiction, or science through fiction, also called science through literature. So this is another side of my interests, literature. And in fact, I'm a playwright as well, and I derived a play called Quakes, for example, from this book, Cry the Beloved Mind. Again, it's available on brainvoyage.com.
Well, it's definitely a good book, not one that you feel like you're stuck having to, you know, to get through the end of the page. So I applaud you. Okay, here's my first question from your book. Now, I'm going to tell you from the start off, just for my listeners, you have so much information. I'm going to go a little bit in the book, but I have a million other questions outside this book that's within your field of expertise, so be patient with me. All right, the first thing that I wanted to ask you about, you talked about catatonia and behavior episodes, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. So I wanted to talk about that for a minute. How does someone know if someone is retarded or has a real brain problem, or if it's specifically something that's a chemical imbalance somewhere? Does that make sense?
Yes, makes a lot of sense. Of course, the basic answer would be consult with your physician, because this is a complex area. But I'll try and make this simpler from a lay point of view. We spoke a lot of heavy-duty conditions here, catatonia, where people might be completely waxy in terms of their movements and completely stationary and not responding to... we call that catatonic stupor, as opposed to catatonic excitement, where they're agitated and they're restless. So that's the one component. And we spoke about behavior disorders. And it's very important when we bear in mind that behavior is the endpoint expression of everything. You can think certain thoughts, you can hallucinate, you can be all deluded, but in fact, in relation to those thoughts, people don't know until it's expressed. So you use the word retarded. You can have retardation.
Wait, hold on one second.
You talk about
disappearing.
Right, we talk about
I mean, are you moving around?
Of slowing of movement, so slow. Thing there.
Dr. Nepi?
Yeah,
you keep
my apologies.
Disappearing. Are you moving around or something?
So, can you hear me there?
Yeah,
we talk about slowing of movements such that there is nothing there. And in that slowing of movements, we have psychomotor retardation. I think that you're referring to it in that context as opposed to people who are mentally retarded.
Yes.
Okay. Now, psychomotor retardation, again, can be a symptom of many conditions. It can be a symptom of depression, and very often is. It can be a symptom of an underlying psychotic condition. It can also be a symptom of confusion, where people are actually clouded in terms of their movements and in terms terms of their thinking and the behavior is therefore slowed. So this is why it's a very non-specific symptom. It's one of those non-specific symptoms like concentration disturbance. And in terms of concentration disturbance, we have an interesting phenomenon. We have the phenomenon of the person says, I cannot concentrate. And it means they could be anxious, they could be depressed, they could be impaired in terms of their thinking in some kind of way. They could have attention deficit disorder. It's very, very nonspecific. So is psychomotor retardation, this absolute slowing.
So let me ask you this. The schools and children of today, and I guess more adults too, have bipolar disorder, and they go off on these rages and get this unbelievable anger. Is that something they can control, or is that something that they do have a chemical imbalance and it can be helped?
That's a wonderful question. You know, people link it up with bipolar disorder, and I must tell you that many times diagnoses of bipolar disorder are made, but the patient is not bipolar. And sometimes the bipolar disorder is missed. And amongst the kinds of symptoms that they might manifest are these explosive outbursts of anger. And very often, these explosive outbursts of anger that they have, these rages that they have, are not linked up with real bipolar disorder. There they might be irritable, very irritable in fact. They might be very agitated. But there is some level of control. Unless they are delusional in terms of their kinds of thoughts, and they've got to act out some of that delusion.
Interesting.
But so people who have explosions in their brain might, in fact, have electrical firing in their brain or electrical misfiring that is abnormal. And this I was fortunate enough to pioneer and show that we could use anticonvulsant medications. We won't call it a kind of seizure disorder, but it's like that. It's the same group of medications, and we're putting out the same kinds of fires. They're abnormal fires in the brain. Now, don't think that anyone who gets angry has abnormal fires in the brain, because there's a second group of people who get irritable because of certain chemical imbalances. For example, they might have some problems with their serotonin system. And these people would not respond to anticonvulsant medications because they haven't got the abnormal fires. They need to have other kinds of medications, for example, the medication buspirone, which is also an area that to some degree I pioneered, this area in irritability and anger and attention deficit disorder. And that will control the serotonergic side. So when we talk about anger and irritability and bipolar in that context, we've got to differentiate between the explosions of rage, which very often need anticonvulsants. And, of course, when I'm talking medically here, one always consults one's physician in this regard. It's a complex area. But on the other hand, we might be talking something chemical. But don't forget that there are also psychological aspects and social aspects and cultural aspects. So I like to use a nice combination word. Ethico, bio, psycho, familio, socio-cultural. And if you think that one is long, for those of you on this program who know all about Eva's interest in consciousness, I actually use the word ethico-spiritual, bio, psycho, familio, socio-cultural, because there's a spiritual or mystical component to many of these experiences as well.
Wow. We're going to get into that question in a few minutes, that's for sure.
So, certainly sounds like it, yes.
Yeah. I have a question here. People who have excessive firing like that, is it something that's constant or is it come and go? And do you think that EMF fields, all the EMF fields that we have going around, the microwaves and the radars and all this stuff, does that have anything to do with it, or is this just something biological?
Okay, those are two excellent questions. The one relates to its constancy, and the second relates to the influences of the environment. The question number one, the constancy. I like to talk about episodic phenomena. Now, you see, it's very easy. Somebody comes to the doctor, they're depressed, they have all these symptoms of depression, they're hopeless and helpless, and they feel inadequate, and there's a loss of self-esteem, and they might be feel like they're nothings, or even feel a little suicidal, and they are feeling very sad, and they're losing experience of pleasure. That's easy, because it's pretty much a constant phenomenon. Might fluctuate during the day, but overall, that's how they've been experiencing it, as opposed to episodic phenomena. Your question was on constant. Are all these constant? The ones that are episodic are missed the whole time. The patient comes to the doctor, looks splendid, he's doing really, really well. And meanwhile, the wife is busy saying, but he has these absolute explosions of rage, or he has these absolute mood disturbances where he fluctuates from moment to moment. And when we hook these people up to sophisticated brainwave
equipment... Wait a minute. Back up a little bit. You just cut out again. Went away.
When we hook them up to sophisticated kinds of brainwave equipment, such as ambulatory EEGs, and we hook them up, for example, over a period of 3 days, they go home, and they have some of these episodes, and they press push buttons, or we watch what's happening while asleep, where the brain is relatively silent, we find that there is this abnormal firing that sometimes is occurring. So this is what we call episodic conditions, and these episodic conditions respond to anticonvulsants. Very, very important, very basic, but very often missed. These fluctuations of mood over seconds, these strange little smells that people have, burning smells, for example, these explosions. Now, to come to your second question, microwaves, the environment. You know, you will find all over all sorts of reports about the dangers of a lot of these electronic pieces of equipment. And one really needs to look at this epidemiologically and analyze this in detail. And the problem is when one analyzes it in detail, we sometimes don't get the answer. You can't just say, well, I looked at 100,000 people and 4,000 had condition A and they weren't exposed to this, and 4,100 had condition B and they were exposed to it, and we think, therefore, that this exposure means something. Because we sometimes find that there are different kinds...
You disappeared.
My apologies. And we sometimes find that there are different kinds of graphs. And in this context, the graphs are rather interesting because we find bimodal kinds of aspects where some people... It makes no difference, maybe, the microwave, but for some people, they're peculiarly sensitive. Now, whether or not this is or is not so, one doesn't know. And I'm not specifically talking about microwaves or electronic pylons or anything else. We have to look at this in detail from an epidemiological study point of view to try to understand whether or not this is or is not relevant. And most of the time, people say, well, it pans out. Nothing happens. We've got no figures. And it's the same with these controversies pertaining to cell phones. And maybe we'll only know in 10, 15, 20 years' time. My own feeling is we've just got to be careful. It's maybe we're at the early stages. You know, people used to say, well, there's no problem with smoking. In the early phases, people would even say it's good because it clears the lungs. We've just got to be careful and limit our exposure to some of these things if we can.
If we have time, after at the end of the show, I want to ask you some questions about glioblastomas and EMF fields, but we'll save that. I want to ask you now about, there's a paragraph in your book where you talk about people that have delusions or auditory hallucinations.
Right.
So, one thing I want to know about this, there are people, and I'm one of these people, who, I haven't always had this ability, but now I have an ability that I'm a medical intuitive. And the way I get my information is I hear it in my head. I'll hear, you know how when you get an idea and you go, oh, that's a great idea. You hear a silent voice in your head and you get some information. So that's the way I'll get it. I'll hear, Eva, tell this person, blah, blah, blah. I don't just get it as a knowing. I hear sentences. So what does that mean to you? Am I having auditory hallucinations?
You know, Eva, you've asked a wonderful question and a very, very important one. Because most lay people think, ah, he's hearing voices, he must be crazy.
Yes.
This is what the common thinking is. So let's start at the beginning. First of all, a hallucination is an experience in one kind of sensory modality. You use the modality of hearing, auditory hallucinations, where there is not an appropriate stimulus from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to an illusion where there's a distortion of a stimulus, but there's something there. Now, the first differentiation is to differentiate between voices that are heard outside the head, in other words, with the ears, compared with stuff that is inside the head.
Okay.
When it's inside the head, we use the word pseudo-hallucinations. They're not even hallucinations. Okay. Now, okay. The difference is the following. That both of them can be normal. Now, people might say, well, wait a minute, that's not what my psychology textbooks tell me. Well, you know, a study done way back in the 1890s by Henry Sidgwick and associates in Britain showed how something like one in every 10 people reported having auditory hallucinations at some point in their lifetime. And they weren't taking crazy people, they were taking ordinary people. And this was repeated by West about 50 years later. And their figures were a little higher. We were talking maybe about one in seven people. And then there was another survey done another 50 years later, round about the same kinds of figures. In other words, there are people around who have auditory pseudo-hallucinations particularly, and auditory hallucinations, who are not only quite normal, they function extremely well and they do very well.
Okay.
The whole point about it is when you look at this, you start saying, could it be that we've got to analyze these kinds of features in a special kind of way, not blanket everything as the person is abnormal, he hears voices. If a person is functioning, is coping, well, look at people saying, I hear the voice of God, you know, and he helps me. Or if they're not religious, they might feel it's their guardian angel. Or they might just think it comes of themselves. They get this idea. Well, wonderful if they can utilize those ideas. That's not abnormal. What becomes abnormal is when it is interfering with their function, when the voice says, do this, do that, they are command hallucinations. So we've got to look at quality of experience, and your example with you helps you. You've mentioned you're a medical intuitive. It helps you. There's a positive component to it. This
but
is not abnormal.
Me.
This is quite normal.
It's someone else's information.
Yeah, that's okay.
So how can it be hallucinatory if it's not about me? If I said, just for example, Vernon, you have prostate cancer, and you went to the doctor, and lo and behold, you have prostate cancer.
Let's use somebody else as that example.
Okay. Somebody then,
right.
Whoever. So I said that, and lo and behold, that person goes, and sure enough, they have it. Then what am I hallucinating? And secondly, what is it that I'm getting?
Okay.
How did I get that?
Two wonderful questions. First of all, you are acquiring information, and we've said, are you hearing it? Are you picking it up in your head? Whatever. You're acquiring information, which you think you're acquiring from the outside. Maybe it's coming from within your brain. It's difficult to debate. Personally, I suspect maybe it is from the outside. But the point about it is, it does not make it in any way abnormal. Where you're getting it from, it's interesting. People will attribute these kinds of experiences, I think, depending on their mystical or spiritual or ethical belief systems. So some might say it's from some kind of supreme being. Some will talk about their guardian angels. Some will talk about it's coming from themselves. It doesn't matter where They will talk about it as coming, but they will acquire the information. Now, let's say the information is correct. We talk about this as a veridical hallucination. In other words, it's a true hallucination in that it came true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how can one say that's wrong if it came true? Now, let's imagine that you come along and you say something, and it does not come true. And yet you picked it up. Does that make you crazy? No, it doesn't. Because when you are predicting things that happen, or that may happen later on, maybe there's such a thing as cause and effect. Maybe there's such a thing as being able to change the cause and change the effect. So you might be picking up information at that moment in time, but at a later moment in time, it may totally change. In which case, your prediction was right that second, but 2 weeks later, that
right.
event did not happen in physical reality.
Okay, my next question is, you talk about, and you were talking about Madeline talking about her daughter Jocelyn. And I understand this woman really had some issues, you know, talking about the Nazis telling her telling her about things. But
yeah.
What about people who, I guess where I'm going is, do you believe that there's some kind of past or previous lives that people live that sometimes they pick up and remember things, or is that a chemical imbalance as well?
You know, this is an interesting question. First of all, let's cut out the word, do I believe? I believe in all sorts of things, but the essence of belief is not knowing something as scientific fact.
That's
so
true.
I like to discuss what I scientifically perceive as likely or less likely. And in the context of this kind of description, we are very often dealing with chemical imbalances. We are dealing with imbalances in the brain. Now, does this discount the reincarnation hypothesis? You know, there have been a great deal of studies in terms of reincarnation, some very, very good studies. One of the greatest experts in this whole area recently passed away, and that was Dr. Ian Stevenson, a psychiatrist. And some of his students became later on his researchers, and other researchers have acquired some remarkable evidence where one could argue that there may be some cogent or very supportive evidence for reincarnative phenomena. Whether or not this is or is not so would be a topic that we could spend many, many hours on. But let me just say that for the ordinary person, it sounds like it's an absolutely crazy idea, but it might not be crazy. Now, let's just imagine for a moment that it was not as crazy an idea as we thought. Could it be then that some of these people are experiencing realities that they haven't fully forgotten about in their previous lives? People use all sorts of phrases in this regard. They talk about previous lives and previous existences. This is a very, very radical hypothesis in medicine, however. And before we would go to the radical hypotheses of reincarnation in medicine, we would go to the more common hypotheses. And certainly 99 times out of 100, or 999 times out of 1,000, we do see a lot of the chemical components.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one patient, rarely, in certain kinds of ways. We start wondering, what is going on here? They're not responding as they should. They're not responding to the appropriate medication. In fact, they're not even tolerating it. Could it be that they are experiencing a reality that others are unable to experience? What a radical hypothesis. Yes, it is radical. We've got to exclude out all other components. But it may be that one's got to approach certain ways of thinking with a more open mind. Just maybe, yes, maybe, we've got to look at all the data that exists. And when we look at all the data that exists, some of these hypotheses that we perceive as absolutely radical may not be quite as radical as we think.
I'm curious, and you don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but I'm curious, do you ever discuss this with your conventional peers, and how do they react to that?
You know, it's very interesting. Yes and no. It's amazing that when I do talk to some of my colleagues about this area, I generally will have a very positive response. Because after all, one's got to understand that something of the order of possibly two-thirds of the population have reported at least what they regard as a psychic experience. I use the technical term subjective paranormal experience. Some kind of experience where there was such a meaningful coincidence that they could not explain those events by ordinary chance phenomena, that under those circumstances they say, hold on, what is happening here? And most of them forget about it. But when it's raised up, it's amazing how positively one does experience their responses. Sometimes one encounters people who become extremely distraught, extremely upset when you dare raise up ideas that may compromise their whole bastion of building blocks that they've built up their whole lifetime. This is the way. There is a stimulus and a response and an organism, and there's nothing else. There is some genetics interacting with environment, and there's nothing else. And when you encounter these kinds of people and you talk about it, this creates a certain rigidity. After all, their whole carefully built edifice may suddenly collapse in a moment if they entertain such ideas. So it requires a certain widening of one's thinking. Maybe it requires a certain creativity. It requires a certain higher awareness of intelligence that maybe we don't have all the answers in the world, that there are other aspects out there that we cannot fully comprehend and we cannot fully understand. And at least we have to approach this with an open mind and try and look at the data and try and develop an evidence-based science in that regard. And this is what I like to call dimensional biopsychophysics. And some call this parapsychological research.
I wish this interview was about 3 hours long, I tell you. Okay, I've got three questions that I want to make sure that I get covered. I'm going to tell them to you, and you can answer them the way you want to.
Yeah.
But let me get the questions out first, because I don't want to forget them. The first one is, I want to talk about deja vu, and I just ask you about parallel universes or either past and future lives, you know, the connection there. Do you think there's a connection? The second one I wanted to talk about is, I read something in your book that I'd not heard anybody else talk about before, and that's the fact that dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine have many receptors, and they're all different. And I was, you know, it made me wonder, is it general knowledge that this is true, and does the SSRIs address that appropriately, or does SAMe or whatever we do address all of those receptors? And then the third thing is spiritual enlightenment. And I don't mean the kind that comes over a period of time where somebody's just grown. I mean spiritual epiphanies where you blink your eye and suddenly you view the world different and you know things that you didn't know before and you understand, you feel like you're one with everything that is and you suddenly find bliss. What is that to you? What happens?
All right, Eva, you've asked me three very complex questions. Let me run through these three relatively briefly. The first was a question on déjà vu. And déjà vu, as you know, is the impression of inappropriate familiarity of the present experience with an undefined past. What this means in lay terms, because this is the way I have defined déjà vu, and this is the recognized now definition of the déjà vu phenomenon. What this means is in order to have this experience, you have to have an awareness of, this is familiar, but it shouldn't be familiar, it's inappropriate. And it's what's happening at that moment, it's present, and there's nothing in the past that could fit in that regard.
Can I flip my question here?
Look at the parallel universes and past and future. Past and future is easier because when we start looking at the deja vu phenomenon, you can't look at it as a single phenomenon. I'm trying to emphasize to you here that we have to phenomenologically analyze. You remember the example of the auditory hallucination?
Mm-hmm.
Not just one kind. There are many different kinds, and we've got to know the context, the content, and the actual process that's going on. Same thing with deja vu. And when we analyze it, and we look at different groups of people who have deja vu experiences, we find that there are qualitative differences. And one of those groups is Wonder of Wonders, a group of people who are called subjective paranormal experience. In other words, what the layperson is conventionally calling psychics. And their deja vu is qualitatively different. Now, where does it fit into past and future? Very simple. These people have distortions of time. They go to a place, and suddenly they feel that they are there, and they've been there before, but it might be from a different time in the past. Or they know what is going to happen in the immediate future. So that's the time distortion that you talked about. You also asked me about parallel universes. This is the place distortion. This is a little bit more complex because sometimes if they go to a place and they feel I've been here before, but it's not really a place, we use the word derealization. And that's a little more complex. But in the same kind of context, bear in mind that there are different kinds of experience, and some of these experiences are extremely real, that they may be linked up with a group called subjective paranormal experience. They may also, with other experiences, be linked up in temporal lobe epilepsy or with normal people. Each one of them have different kinds of experiences, or people who are psychotic, and every one of them will perceive these realities differently. So that's the deja vu question.
But before we go to the next one, I'm going to ask this. I can't help it. Synchronicities, what is that?
You know, I've actually just written a paper linking up synchronicity and talking about the fact that, you know, we neglect it. We neglect talking about this whole area where an event happens involving, say, person John, and it also happens involving his great friend Jim at the same time. Or maybe John and Jim think the same thing at the same time, or they phone each other, or something else. And one says, what's going on here? And here we have to look at all the data that has accumulated. Now, I will tell you one thing. In terms of the data that has accumulated, if you are a legitimate scientist who is open-minded, and you look at the absolute multitude of data that has accumulated in relation to so-called extrasensory perception, and you look at it in the context of a variety of special techniques that are now used to activate such phenomena, the evidence statistically is so overwhelming for extrasensory perception that, as far as I'm concerned, it's as much a fact as anything else. It's still a rare event. It still occurs spontaneously. But you asked about synchronicities. This may well be one component relating to synchronicity.
Okay.
Now let's move on to your question number two. You were asking about the different neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin and norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. And you were saying there seem to be sub-neurotransmitters. The layperson says, well, it works on serotonin. Well, in fact, there are somewhere between 13 and 15 serotonin receptor subtypes. They're different kinds of serotonin. They work in different chemicals. They work in different ways. In fact, one kind of serotonin, serotonin 1A, in terms of activation, might balance serotonin 2A in terms of blocking. They might both have some anti-anxiety effects, for example. So we have this peculiar balance of what is occurring. It's like an absolute symphony, an absolute orchestra, the one talking to each other. And they talk between receptors, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, and a whole string of others. It's like a whole cacophony, but it comes together as a beautiful, magnificent, supreme symphony, all working together. And these subreceptor subtypes. So it's extremely complex. So now when you use an example such as a group of medications called the SSRIs or the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs, these are antidepressants that act selectively, or by definition act selectively, on serotonin. Very little at that clinical level is acting on other receptors, although, again, it varies depending on the particular drug. So you said, well, does it work on dopamine? Does it work on norepinephrine? No. And this is why, very often with these SSRI drugs, because, for example, they're used to treat depression, and those depressions have both serotonin and norepinephrine involved, after a year or so, the patient says, it was working, doctor, but it's no longer working. And some doctors will say, well, let's jack up the dose. But the reality is they've got to look at some of these other receptors. Again, consult your physician. Every case is a little different, but this gives you a little bit of a perspective. So every one of these drugs are different, just like SAM-E was another example you used, is different, because that is, if you want, a precursor. And you can build up certain levels of certain chemicals, and that's wonderful, but you've got to get the right balance. Remember, taking 50 aspirins is not a good idea, but sometimes a little baby aspirin is perfect. One's got to have the right dose at the right time for the right person under the right condition using the right physician. Question number three. Or do you want to cover some more on that, Eva?
Well, let me tell you what time it is, because I could talk. I could ask 50 more questions, and we don't have enough time.
Okay.
You're going to have to come back. Promise me.
All right. Well, that's a possibility to come back, certainly. I enjoy this.
I do, too.
Spiritual enlightenment was your third question.
10:43, though, Vernon, so we've got till 10:56.
Okay. Spiritual enlightenment was your third question, and this is a really complex one. You use the word, not something that one gradually acquires over time, but suddenly the person has an absolute epiphany, an absolute awareness. Wow!
Yes.
Suddenly, one's life is entirely different. Now, one finds very often epiphanies occurring with life-changing events, and the classic example, for example, is the near-death experience. A person didn't believe in anything, and suddenly nearly dies, in fact, supposedly does die, and has this dramatic, powerful, profound experience, which is subjective, okay? They cannot prove it happened, but they know it happened in their own mind. And there are those who say, well, this is all due to your chemicals in your brain, and some who say, wait a minute, this is far beyond chemicals. They had an epiphany. There was a total change. To them, many of these people perceive that as an enlightening experience. And you use the word spiritual. In science, we don't particularly like the word spiritual, because when one does, people say, wait a minute, that's not science, that is religion, whatever it is. Mystical is almost accepted, but let us say this is a profound life-saving or life-changing circumstance that very much changes one's way of thinking. And, yeah, epiphanies occur, and epiphanies can be quite normal, but again, we've got to look at it in this whole context. Of you will remember, the ethico-spiritual-mystico-bio-psycho-familio-socio-cultural framework.
Well, is it a function that, I know I have an opinion, but I'm not going to insert my opinion here. Is it a function of brain, or is it some sort of function where mind is able to access more somehow?
Excellent question. Let me give you the answer briefly. I started asking this very question. I said, look, people are having subjective paranormal experiences. They're describing these experiences, and I know they are for real. For them, they are subjectively real. The question comes up, does it occur from within the brain, or is there a particular pattern of brain functioning that allows them to experience this reality? And I started looking at this, and I decided that it should be the temporal lobe of the brain, because the temporal lobe of the brain is that area of the brain, of a higher brain, that is the great integrator. And maybe it was integrating so-called subjective paranormal experiences as well. And wonder of wonders, I was able to demonstrate in my research that patients, or that people, subjects, normal subjects, who have subjective paranormal experiences also have different, what we call anomalous temporal lobe functioning. It doesn't mean to say it's abnormal or normal, it's just different. And that allows them to experience maybe a reality that others can't experience. And then I looked at the reverse. We did this as very detailed research, and we're talking about published research in recognized journals with Dr. John Palmer and myself. Dr. Palmer is editor of the Journal of Parapsychology, very well-known parapsychological researcher, and we looked at people with temporal lobe disease, with temporal lobe epilepsy, and wonder of wonders, they were having subjective paranormal experiences. So your question is it a function of the brain or not? Personally, I suspect that there is a reality out there that most people are unable to experience usually. But that with this anomalous function of the brain, this allows them to experience this reality. On the other hand, I could just as easily argue, if I did not have all the other facts, like I've spoken about the facts that extrasensory perception is proven, so it must come from somewhere. If I didn't have all those facts, I could just as easily argue this is a chemical aberration that is occurring in the temporal lobe of the brain, and this is all crazy.
Well, I love the way you answered it.
Well, thank you. I really do.
All right. What was my next question? Don't let me forget this question. It just flew out of my head. Shoot.
There's so many different aspects here to look at that obviously you've got to figure through what are you going to ask now.
Well, I had one that I really I know what it was. Do you think that thought creates?
Well, you know, your questions don't get any easier, Eva.
I'm sorry, but you're my only brain guy that I've had. Everybody else has been physicists or biologists, and I'm...
Okay.
So many questions for you.
So I think the thought creates, and I'm pleased you did not use the word, do I believe the thought creates, because I would have said it's a scientific component. Well, by using the word, do I think the thought creates, it's a rather paradoxical, because we're thinking a thought. And we get back to René Descartes in terms of, you know, cogito ergo sum, you know, I think therefore I am. So in that context, yes, thought creates.
Well, let me ask you this.
And it creates a whole philosophical framework here. I know what you're really referring to.
I'm talking about Bill Taylor's work.
That by thinking a particular thought, you may be able to get closer to actualizing that as a physical reality.
Or does it manipulate math? Maybe that's a better question. Maybe that's an easier question to address.
Again, I'm going to look at it this way. The approach in science is to look at the simplest, the most parsimonious, the easiest explanation. In other words, there's a so-called Occam's razor. And to hypothesize that thinking can manipulate mass is an absolutely profound and radical thought. It is a thought that our conventional sciences could not even begin to entertain. But you know what? When we say thinking influences matter, or thinking influences events, we are talking about a phenomenon in psi phenomena, in parapsychological research, called psychokinesis, mind over matter. This is what we are talking about. And so in order to answer this question, I have to look at the detail and the evidence in relation to psychokinesis. And this is an extremely complicated area. We've got a few minutes, and there's no way I can cover that area in those few minutes. Let me just say that there is some detailed and cogent evidence in terms of events occurring following on manipulation of events by other than one's recognized muscles and motor organs. Whether this implies psychokinesis or thought-creating matter is a problem because of the fact that most of the time when we're talking about events that actualize in reality, we're also talking about something else. We're talking about realities that may occur because we know the future. We have precognition. We have an awareness. What is going to happen next? Immediately later. So if we try to, for example, say, well, we're going to get this dice to spin and go on sixes more than it should, and it does do that, well, we could argue, yeah, indeed, that seems to support psychokinesis, provided everything else was very, very adequately controlled. Let's say we even made this more electronic that on a computerized level, random numbers, and it was generating more commonly. But is the thought or the mind manipulating the matter or the event? Or are we in some kind of way just precognizing, being aware of the future? And this is the big question there. But your question is a very powerful one, a very big one, and a very important one for scientists who are looking in detail at parapsychological research. I think it's far easier for the conventional scientist to say, yeah, the data for extrasensory perception is cogent. When they look at the data of mind over matter, of thought creating some kind of event, of your being able to change some kind of fabric there, this is very threatening because they certainly would have to unthink all that they've thought before.
Absolutely. Wow, I've really enjoyed this interview. Thank you. You've got 3 minutes to say whatever you want to say.
Well, what I'll say is something I said at the beginning. As some of you may find some of my books stimulating, Cry the Beloved Mind, A Voyage of Hope, which is both in hard copy and in electronic form. My whole Deja Vu series of books, with respect, is the most important series of books written on Deja Vu. In fact, the psychology of Deja Vu pioneered the whole area of Deja Vu research. And these are just areas that may stimulate. Some of you might want to look at PNI. This is all on brainvoyage.com. Some of you might want to look at PNI.org. And PNI.org is an interesting website. All sorts of stimulating areas. One thing I can promise, you'll be stimulated by it. You'll be stimulated by the neuropsychiatry, by the psychopharmacology, by the philosophy, by the research, and by the voyage of exploration into the anomalous. And one area from a philosophical point of view you might find interesting is an early discussion of a philosophical theory I've been trying to develop called Vortex N-Dimensionalism. On that website, it'll be under Vortex Pluralism, which talks about a multidimensional reality in a special kind of way, maybe infinite. And this itself is very, very fascinating. So brainvoyage.com, and do remember to put in Talk Radio. If you want to purchase any of those books, you'll get a reduction, and you'll get a bulk reduction as well if you purchase more than one. And also, PNI.org, Pacific Neuropsychiatric Institute.org, or Peter Norman Ivan. So those are a few little words to mention about where to obtain extra information.
Vernon, I can't thank you enough. That was a thoroughly informative and enjoyable interview. Thank you.
It's my absolute pleasure.
I'm going to contact you next week for you to come back sometime.
Thank you so much, Eva.
Take care and good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.